Today is Tuesday, October 14th, the year 2003. We're in East Lansing, Michigan. I am Jeff Charnley, interviewing Charles Curry for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of the institution to be commemorated in the year 2005. As you can see, Mr. Curry, we have a tape recorder for this oral history today. Do you give us permission to record the interview?
I do.
Okay. I'd like to start first with some general questions about your personal and educational background. Where were you born and raised?
Ann Arbor, Michigan was the place of birth, raised in primarily in Homer, Michigan.
Okay. Is that in Jackson County or Calhoun?
That's Calhoun County.
Calhoun County, okay. You went to high school in Homer?
Homer, correct.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And what year did you graduate?
1950.
Okay. Did you see any military service or?
I did. I was in Air Force ROTC in college and served 2 years in the Air Force thereafter.
So when did you serve?
1955 to 57.
Okay. And in the Air Force, what was your main job?
Well, technically I was an intelligence officer with the Strategic Air Command.
How long then did you serve?
2 years.
2 years, uh-huh. And what rank were you when you got out?
First Lieutenant.
First Lieutenant. did you go on to college after that, or?
After the Air Force, I taught school for 3 years, and then went and came to Michigan State to get a master's degree in guidance and counseling.
Okay, and I forgot to ask about your undergraduate career. Where did you go for that?
That was Denison University in Granville, Ohio.
Okay. What was it about that university that attracted you at the time?
My dad went there. Terrible reason to go, but it worked out fine.
Okay. And we're always interested in finding out why people make the decision to come to Michigan State. What were those circumstances?
Well, I decided I wanted to get an advanced degree in counseling. I looked at the programs at Ohio State, Michigan, and Michigan State. And something that affected me profoundly later on, I found that Ann Arbor and Columbus were willing to have me come. I was qualified, and Michigan State basically said, "We want you." Mm-hmm. And there was also National Defense Education Act Guidance Institute going into effect, an academic year institute, the first of its kind at Michigan State that year, so I applied for that and was granted a position on that. I was also granted a position as a graduate advisor in a residence hall, but I could not accept both.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the NDEA Institute.
Okay, NDEA.
NDEA, which granted me probably half of my master's degree. It was mm-hmm. only a one semester institute.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. So you used the GI Bill also?
No.
Or you didn't?
Okay. No, they just the institute.
Okay. All right. When you first got to campus, what were any of the first impressions that you had?
Well, I was attracted by the looks of the campus. I had been here just occasionally, football games and the like. I had grown up a University of Michigan fan because my parents had roots there. Mm-hmm. And I was in the first group of students ever to live in Owen Hall.
Oh.
In the fall of 1960. I had started in summer school just to kind of get a jump on the grad program. And the other impression was that the professors and instructors in the College of Education were pretty first rate.
Mm-hmm. Were there any that in those early years when you were working on your master's that you worked with closely? Or
my advisor was Walt Johnson.
Okay.
And although I never had the good fortune of having a class from him, he was a terrific advisor and remained in contact with him over the years.
Uh-huh. What did you see as maybe his strength there that you?
Oh, he was just his personality. He was just a hail fellow, well met. He was just one of the guys, and very warm, and the other characteristic about him is what he was nationally known in his field. Mm-hmm. He had previously been president of the American Personnel Guidance Association, so he was known nationwide. Okay.
Did you stay at MSU all that time after that, or did you?
No, I got my master's after one calendar year, and then took a job as a counselor at a relatively new school district, Cherry Hill School District in suburban Detroit. It was in Inkster. It was between Dearborn and Wayne, Michigan, Wayne Westland, and it was the second year of the school's existence. And the nice characteristic about that is my colleagues there, two of them had come out of the University of Michigan Guidance Program, which had a person, Ed Raber, who was very much like Walter Johnson here, his counterpart there. And the Michigan people sort of supervised or oversaw what was going on at Cherry Hill High School. So they had really some direct consulting going on there.
Mm-hmm. Close links between that.
Was very good.
Mm-hmm. What in your counseling duties in some of those early years, were there anything that you were mainly responsible for? Or
no, we divided the four counselors, and we had a very good workload. I mean, we were less than 250-1 in terms of ratio, which was, again, thanks to U of M, I think. And the philosophy which came out of U of M was as simplistic as you can get. See kids.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. Mm-hmm. There are so many things that can buffer between counselors and kids, duties and additional responsibilities and so on that can get in the way of that. If you keep that in the forefront, mm-hmm. that works. We divided the kids up alphabetically, and the philosophy there was that you keep abreast of all the things that go on in grades 9 through 12, and 12th year being critical because that's the next year before college or work or whatever. And so you're always up to date with that. And the other thing is that by doing it alphabetically, you had all the kids in the same family. So if there were family issues and there was more than one sibling in the school, you could deal with it from more than one direction.
Mm-hmm. Was that innovative at the time, or did
not
it just
really?
Work,
but it wasn't universal.
Certainly. Okay, yeah, certainly logical in terms
yeah.
of
yeah. You can argue, you can argue other ways too, but I always thought that was the best way to go.
Yeah, seems to make sense. The how many years were you there?
I just stayed 2 years.
2 years. Okay, and next on your job path?
Well, my ambition was to get a job as a counselor in an overseas American high school.
Oh, okay.
And I discovered I wasn't qualified because in my NDEA Institute and master's program at MSU, I had never had the opportunity to take an individual testing course. in other words, learning how to administer a test one-on-one, which was a requirement of overseas schools. So I said I'd go back and get the course, and come back later. In the meantime, Michigan State came calling and offered me a job. I'd gotten to know some people in the admissions staff. Mm-hmm. I had known the director of admissions, Bill Finney, at the time, because he used to officiate football games when I was coaching in Homer. And also met another man on the staff, Russ Wentworth by name, who became my mentor. And during my second year at Cherry Hill, they asked me to come to Michigan State and start work the following summer. For a long, 11-month contract basically versus 10-month and at less pay. It took me a month to decide on that one. That was a little tough. Mm-hmm.
So what year did you start?
1963.
1963.
In July.
Okay. And you had family at that time?
No.
No.
I was
okay.
not married.
Uh-huh. The when your what were your duties in admission in that era?
I worked in freshman admissions, and the staff was growing at that time. We were in the student services building, occupied most of the second floor there, and so it involved visiting high schools, recruiting, covering college nights, handling correspondence, interviews, all of which was basically on-the-job training with some of the veterans there.
To what degree did President Hanna get involved with
indirectly, only through Dutch Gordon Sabine. He had assigned admissions and office to Gordon Sabine, I'm not sure exactly when, late 50s sometime. And so his influence was well in motion. And they just wanted to build on the fact that Michigan State was now in a Big Ten Conference, had been for a few years. And it was time for the university to kind of meet that standard in terms of student population, quality of student population.
Were you involved in any of Dr. Sabine and President Hanna's efforts to attract the Alumni Distinguished Scholars?
Oh, intimately. Yes.
Well, how did you first hear about that program, or what?
Pardon?
What was? How did you first hear about that program, and
or? Oh, just when I first got on the staff.
Okay.
And,
so
through the first year of it, and that program was just beginning to grow, and they were just starting the recruitment of National Merit semifinalists. So I was pretty much in on the ground floor of that the year. They had actually started the year before, and I first heard about that because a couple of the students at Cherry Hill, the valedictorian and salutatorian, were in that category and were recruited by Michigan State, and one of them did come here. In fact, both of them came here. So I experienced a little bit from the high school point of view and then came here and did the other end of it.
That wasn't just targeting MSU students. I mean, it wasn't just targeting Michigan students, right?
No. They went national. I mean, Dr. Sabine had the idea, or got the idea, that the National Merit Corporation was looking for more sponsors. All the sponsorships in that program were corporate. And sometime a year or two before he got involved in, he discovered that a college in Vermont, Bennington, I believe, had somehow been allowed to sponsor a merit scholarship for one of its incoming freshmen. And he said, aha, why can't we do that? And so in 1963, and I'm trying to think whether it started in 60, it was a class of, the high school class of 63 or 64, I think 63, he went to the National Merit Corporation and said, Michigan State will sponsor 150 National Merit Scholarships. And the condition being, of course, that the student must pick Michigan State first before it can pick them as a merit scholar, meaning that the National Merit procedure calls for the students in the middle of their senior year to declare their first choice college or university. And if they declared Michigan State at that point, then Michigan State could then choose them as one of their merit scholars. And that's how the bandwagon got going. Of course, we were also hoping to attract, and did attract, quite a number of the other sponsored merit scholarships, the corporate sponsors. And there's also a fixed number of National Merit Scholars who were sponsored by the national office itself.
How did that, how did you see that changing the student body in the 60s?
Oh, I think it changed the quality dramatically, because as you go through the 60s, through most of the 60s, counting the scholarships we sponsored, we ended up being the university in the country with the largest number of merit scholars on campus. More than any of the Ivy League schools, particularly Harvard. Of course, Harvard would always want to put an asterisk on it because they didn't sponsor any merit scholarships. They simply attracted all the others as they could. But the fact that a relatively unknown regional public university could get into that game and attract kids from across the country was phenomenal. The Alumni Distinguished Scholarship Program was really a carrot. The purpose, I mean, the reward for the winners was 10 full ride scholarships for 4 years of undergraduate education. But at that time, it was just the 10 awards. There are more now, and at a couple of different levels. But at that time, it was just the 10. And students were invited to the campus, and they had to physically come to the campus to compete for these awards, which this competition took place on the first two weekends in February. We split the invitee group into two groups because of the size. And at the peak of that, I think in the early 60s, we would have as many as 1,800 or 1,900 high school seniors on campus split between the two weekends, which was basically a Friday, Saturday. The culmination of that was the ADS exam, which was an examination which our staff was never allowed to see. It was developed by the testing office in the University College at the time. Dr. Gwen Norell and the Counseling Center was kind of instrumental in that as well. I was told that the exam consisted primarily of many of the toughest questions on the final exams of the University College required courses, ATL being one, and Natural Science, Social Science, and Humanities. Mm-hmm. That was kind of the core of the exam. So it was an MSU exam. It had only one purpose, and that was to discriminate among all these very bright high school seniors, all of whom had to have at least an A-minus average and very high test scores just to get invited, and then try to identify the top 10 among those to get those awards. But the opportunity for those awards are what attracted the kids to the campus in the first place. And then once the kids got to campus, the campus sold itself to some extent. Of course, we made sure they had a chance to get contact with faculty and the fields of interest they had. Mm-hmm. By the way, parents were invited too. And there were some information sessions, and of course, they had a chance to learn about the Honors College up close. And even though you ran into a weather risk in early February, the kids, by the nature of the program, they at that time, they stayed in residence halls. This is no longer true, but Michigan State students were invited to volunteer an extra bed in their room. Maybe the roommate was going to be away for the weekend, or maybe they had a third bed or a cot that could be put in there. Mm-hmm. And so students were invited to host ADS students. Mm-hmm. And for a number of years, that's the way they were housed. Mm-hmm. And so they got an intimate look at the residence halls. And of course, back in the 60s, that was a big building boom in residence halls here. And that certainly contributed, I think, to the positive effect. They got intimate contact with MSU students and faculty, and so many of these kids came that probably never would have come to Michigan State without any scholarship help at all. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of them became National Merit Scholars, but of the 17 to 1900 kids who came in any given year, less than a majority of them were National Merit semifinalists. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were, but the majority were not. But they were all very bright kids. So the other carrot that I think greatly influenced the attraction of the kids was the Honors College. Because I was told when I came here in the early 60s that when it was formed in the middle 50s, it was unlike any other honors program in the country. There was nothing like it. People marveled at how the administration here got the faculty to agree to this fairly liberal, kind of a flexible program, which essentially told a student, here's the kid who qualified for the Honors College, here's the university catalog, You may take any course in this catalog when you're ready, including graduate courses. That's a degree of flexibility that just didn't exist. And for a number of years after that, there were visitors on this campus every year from other colleges and universities finding out how this worked and what was going on, so they could try to copy it for their program. But it was probably another 10 years at least before it began to have any rivals in other universities around the country. So when students who are that bright and want the opportunity to waive classes, to substitute more advanced courses for the required basic classes, that flexibility was all there. They could go as fast as they want, although that was not the purpose of the Honors College. The purpose of the Honors College was depth, to get them to go really deep into their field or fields of interest. That's why the graduate courses were opened up to them.
How important was advising in the Honors College itself?
That was critical too. Of course, the Honors College, as it does today, had its own staff, and they essentially advised indirectly advised everybody, but they advised directly the no-preference students, kids who hadn't picked their field of study yet. When the student had picked his field of study, whether it was at the beginning or later on, then they were assigned to a faculty person who was an honors advisor in that discipline. And then they followed them through to their degree.
Mm-hmm. Did President Hanna, did he address those ADS applicants or the
no,
others?
No, he did not. Mm-hmm. And which somewhat interesting, because later on the MSU presidents did get more directly involved in the ADS program. But Dr. Sabine was the chief honcho of all of that. Okay. He ran or mentored all of that program, National Merit, ADS.
Yep. And we should note for the record that he died just recently.
Just a month ago.
A month ago.
Yeah. Correct.
The seems to be an interesting legacy. How about some of the students who, the younger students? There were some attempt to attract some of the those that came earlier than what they normally would graduate from high school. The really young students, were there
not really
admissions involved in that in any way?
Well, yes, they were, but there was no attempt to attract them. There are, of course, programs around here today working with high school gifted students, but back then, no. But occasionally there would surface a really bright early teenager, the admissions office will get involved, Dr. Sabine will get involved, Dr. Norrell and the counseling center will get involved and what to do for that person. There was one student here in East Lansing, and I can't remember the name exactly now, but who was allowed to come to Michigan State and take courses at probably 12, 13, 14 years of age. Eventually becoming a full-time student before really having finished East Lansing High School. I was told that Michigan State was never anxious to get any publicity for this kind of thing. They really didn't want this to be something that the public thought, any parent thought they had a bright kid could send him to Michigan State. Mm-hmm. And so on, the condition was that there would be no publicity from the university or the family about this student being here. Well, within his first year here, he was in Life magazine, courtesy of his parents, uh-huh. Which did not sit well with the people here. Later on, and I can't remember when this might have been, back in the early 70s, there was a young man from Ionia, Michigan, and I can't remember his name. Gwen, Dr. Norrell would know, but he was so young and so small his feet wouldn't reach the floor when he sat in the chair. But he was president of the National Honor Society, he was a senior at Ionia High School, and he was ready to go to college. Mm-hmm. And the question was where. And his mother was a school teacher and his dad was a pharmacist, and his Michigan State said, after considerable interviews and consternation and discussions with he and his parents, that he could come here, but he could not be in the residence halls. He's just too young. Mm-hmm. He had to live with his parents, and which meant his parents had to pull up roots and move, mm-hmm. and they did. they came to the Lansing area so that he can go to school here. And but he was so young that academically he was among his peers, but in between classes he had to go to Dr. Norell's office, and she would find little make do work for if he didn't have homework to do, mm-hmm. keep him busy. She got him a job as a ball boy in the foot for the football team. So he went to football practice in the fall every day. And
was that in the 60s or that 70s?
That's I think early 70s.
Early 70s, okay.
I'd probably have to get her to refresh my memory, but so those kinds of cases came along occasionally. Another student who came prematurely was the daughter of the Carolyn Orr at the Beaumont Tower, mm-hmm. Wendell Westcott. And she came out of Eastern High School. And there were some other. There was one who came here prematurely, like 15 or 16 years of age, as high school graduate from Dayton, Ohio. He might have been a National Merit Scholar, I'm not sure, but he turned out to be a problem. There were social problems, and he got in Dungeons and Dragons and got involved in the tunnel system in Michigan State University. I don't know, it was bizarre. I wasn't intimately involved with those kids, but.
Mm-hmm. The activism of the 60s, how did that affect admissions? Did you see any connection between?
Well, I wasn't here at that time. Mm-hmm. I came in 63 and left in 68 to become director of admissions at Hope College in Holland. And the activism was really peaked in that time I was gone. So I can't really comment very much about that. I sure it had some effect. I think it eventually had, at least into the 70s, eventually had an effect on how the ADS program operated. We students were not very trustworthy in some respects in terms of hosting MSU students in the ADS program, or ADS students rather, on campus, and so we had to take that out and move it to Kellogg Center and other venues. And so, but what direct impact there was, I couldn't say.
Mm-hmm. How long were you at Hope?
I was there 3 years mm-hmm. as director, and in two independent decisions, not related to each other, I left Hope College and returned to Michigan State, summer of 71.
Did you come back to admissions?
Yes, I came back to admissions. At the time, my mentor, Russ Wentworth, was leaving MSU to become director of admissions at Wichita State University. He took with him a colleague and a staff member named Stan Henderson, whom I had recruited in the first or second National Merit Scholarship class we ever had. I had the interview with he and his mother in my office. He came from the little town in Illinois. He came to Michigan State, graduated, went to Cornell, got a master's degree, came back to Michigan State to be in the admissions staff at the time I left to go to Hope. And so he was here for the 3 years I was not here. Mm-hmm. And he followed Russ to Wichita State, and as Russ Wentworth went up the ladder job-wise at Wichita State, Stan Henderson became director of admissions at Wichita State. I also indirectly recruited his wife. He married a national merit, or a really bright girl from Livonia Bentley High School, and they came back to Western Michigan University. He became director of admissions there. It was in the 80s, I think. Was there a few years, then he went to Cincinnati as director of enrollment planning there. Was interviewed for the admissions job here at Michigan State at the behest of myself and Russ Wentworth a year and a half ago. Was one of the two finalists, did not get the job, which he says he wanted a job really badly, but he was glad it worked out because he is now the director of admissions at the University of Illinois as of 2 months ago.
Job progression for him.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a sidebar to all this. The admissions staff at Michigan State in the 1960s was probably the greatest collection of talent in that bent anywhere in the country at any university at any time ever. and some of us got together for a memorial service for Dr. Sabine last week. Bill Finney, who hired me, died within a year of that time, but you know, Russ went with us. It went into Wichita State. Terry Carey became director in the 60s. He later became vice president of Central Michigan University, which is his alma mater. Our staff consisted of, at one time, everybody in our staff, or almost everybody, had been in secondary school teaching, most likely also in counseling, or as a principal and as a coach. They all had secondary school experiences. By the 1970s,